going to discuss what it takes to break artists in the UK, specifically Scandinavian artists in the UK. I'm joined by three artist managers, and I will allow them to introduce themselves, starting at this end with Tim Hall.
Hello there, I'm Tim Hall, I'm from Audio Authority Management, and I look after seven record producers, and also co-manage the Danish band Kellenich.
Stephen?
My name's Stephen King. I'm not a manager anymore. I retired a couple of weeks ago after 25 years. I got bored of it. And I managed, amongst others, Burning Spear, Incognito, Mew from Denmark, The Hives from Sweden, Beck Runger from New Zealand, Libertines from England, Mogwai from Scotland, and a few others.
And John.
Hi, Jonathan Morley. I manage Tina Dico, Hush from Denmark, and three UK acts, Kate Walsh, Shine Soraya, and Jono McCleary.
Okay, well, let's kick off. Can we start off maybe talking about radio in the UK? And what's the most important thing in terms of breaking artists? Because obviously, the UK has national radio, which has, you know, a fantastic reach. But it's very hard getting an unknown act onto UK radio. So how would you approach that? Maybe I'll start with you, John.
Well, if we're talking specifics, we're talking Scandinavian artists, I'll talk about Tina and I'll talk about Hush. Whereas Hush is then known outside Denmark, they're known as the Sound of Hush. But with Tina, it's tough. I mean, it's obviously she's from here, she's a big star here, and it's not easy here either, but she has a lot more favourite radio. But in the UK, over the last couple of records, it hasn't been easy. She got a break with in the Red record, but we had a strategy in mind when that came out. We knew that the radio plugger that we work with, who's the guy that takes the record to radio to see what we can get on the radio, suggested that we went to radio around Christmas time, because they have got Radio 2, which was the radio station we were aiming at getting on. They have a playlist meeting just before Christmas, which then covers the New Year period, and historically it's always been the quietest time to get a new artist on the radio. And this is 5 years ago, and things have changed a lot since then, and we managed to get her on the playlist, and she was album of the week, and we got a foot in the market, and from there things started to happen. But since then it's become a lot more difficult. The other labels and everybody else now realises that's a quiet month, and they'll always try and put records out during that period too, so there really isn't a good time to put a record out if you're a new artist over there. That said, if you've got the right records, then you stand the hope. And with Hush, we put out a compilation of theirs in the UK earlier in the year, partly because I just feel that they've got some really strong radio music, which they have on the radio here a lot. And actually, it worked. We did get on the radio in the UK. We've got on a playlist over there. Again, it starts to stall when my problem, the acts I work with, is they're not signed to big labels. And the radio stations and the media in general want to start seeing a lot of money being spent to start backing up the project, because otherwise they worry about having led the project on radio, but there's nothing else in the press, there aren't any adverts on television. So that's, in my mind, it's getting tougher. It's getting tougher for British acts, because they have the same problems, but for acts coming from outside, where there's no real story, I guess it's getting even tougher than it was a few years ago.
I think that's, can I just make a comment on that? That, you know, when you're approaching radio in the UK, generally they like to think that they're discovering new talent, but generally their process of discovering new talent is when actually a year to 2 years of extremely hard work has been done to generate a big enough audience so that an artist can play to at least a few hundred people. They've had reviews, photo shoots, people writing about them on blogs, all sorts of low level generation of interest. So then when you go to radio, they of course want to know about how much money you're going to spend. They also want to know how many singles you've got and what your 12-month plan is for releasing them. So they want to see over the next 12 months, if they support one record and their listeners like it, have you got something to follow that up, which is going to be the same quality or even better? And have you got something to follow that and something to follow that too? So actually, when you're going, by the time you go to radio, you have to have this great portfolio of press, this great word of mouth on the street that this thing's really, really hot and happening. And then when you get, for example, the BBC Radio 1 involved, they're going to be able to break it to a much bigger audience than that kind of low-level tastemaker audience. and it's going to be kind of risk-free for them. And actually, famously, the head of music at Radio 1 was quoted in the trade magazine Music Week about a year and a half ago as suggesting that no one should sign a band unless they played it to him first, which was a massively arrogant thing for him to say, because he basically said, you know, without me, you can exist bubbling on the underground. We're the people who are going to make it successful. But I think the fallacy is people think they can run straight to radio and that'll break their record. But the reality is you won't even be in contention unless you've already done an amazing amount of work to build a lot of interest with the, you know, those what you call early adopters in the audience world.
Stephen, could you maybe break down specialist radio?
Yeah, but I'd like to take a step back.
Okay, go ahead.
Because I think you can introduce a market to anyone, but you have to make them understand the market. And one of the things that we did at Creation in bringing international bands into the UK is we brought them in and we explained to them the market. We said to them, this is how radio works in the UK, this is how press works in the UK, this is the relative importance of blogs, this is the relative importance of the NME, this is why touring works for your sort of band, this is how you fit into the system. We spent a lot of time, 6 months with bands, encouraging them to understand the market, because without that clear understanding of the market, they couldn't understand when a radio plugger said to them, your record doesn't fit into the programming. So I think it was crucial all the time that as soon as we took someone in, we made them understand the market, even before they made the record sometimes.
But that's why I was going to ask you to break down a little bit more UK radio. So for instance, you know, Tim talks about Radio 1, John talks about Radio 2. Can you explain what those are and how they kind of break down and you know, what their importance is?
Also, there. I mean, part of this is there is a cultural thing here, especially with the Danish market. And from what I hear and my experiences, the P3, actually, if you take them and plug them a single and they like it, it's got a good chance of being played. Whereas with Radio 1, with the BBC, which is kind of the UK equivalent of P3, it's not just a question of them liking it. It's got to have that whole groundswell behind it. But then we also have enough stations to be able to break them down a little bit by genre and by specialist genre as well. So you heard also about Radio 2, and they kind of access a market which is over 25 and is a little bit lighter weight, if you like, and a bit more classic in its songwriting support. And then we have independent stations like XFM, which support more kind of indie bands and rock. But then after sort of 7 p.m. in the evening in the UK, that's when a bit more experimentation and specialism can come in, and all the radio stations will do some sort of specialist feature on drum and bass or metal or grime and hip-hop and all those kind of things. And there is a tendency, with Kelemench, who I manage, we've had live sessions with Radio 1 and with XFM, but they've been played out on specialist slots, and it's a very intangible area of broadcast in the UK to know whether or not we're going to get a bounce back from the audience that hear it, and it's going to actually materialise into something real. I think a lot of these stations, like Radio 1, they use their specialist shows, and especially text messaging and emailing from the audience, to find out whether or not there's enough groundswell appeal in the artist. So we've got this DJ called Zane Lowe, who's notorious for breaking new, edgy acts. And when all the DJs do this now, he'll play a track out and he'll say, let's hear from you on the text whether you like this. And the radio station will actually be using it as market research to find out, you know, if they get 3,000 kids texting in saying this is amazing, but then they've immediately got a reason to have a meeting and say, shall we support this band further? Whereas if they only get a few hundred people or less, it's kind of, well, this is going to keep bubbling along at specialist level. So that they know how to refine the interest very, very closely.
I suppose the one area that you haven't talked about is that we also have local radio stations in the UK, and they can be quite important for breaking new acts, because they don't have as rigid a playlist policy as the major stations, but it takes a tremendous amount of hard work. So if a band's on tour and you're saying to them every day you have to go into two local radio stations, and you know the hit rate of you picking up a playlist from them is about 1 in 10, I'd say probably 1 in 10 if you're lucky. So it's a lot of hard work, but it does help sell you tickets. So you have both areas. I can't actually think of an example of a band that's broken by using that method, but it has helped bands in local areas and has built up the story.
I can say where it has been useful. In the UK, we have a promotional kind of process called club promotions. And when a band releases a track which is at all of any appeal to any kind of nightclub, they'll send it out to all the DJs that play that kind of music all around the country. And what those DJs have to do to enable them to keep getting free records from pluggers, they have to supply their feedback as to what it is. And actually it's really useful when you put a single out and you get goes to all the DJs in the country and you get the report back, and you suddenly see that, you know, in Bournemouth, the guy played it on a club night and it filled the dance floor and people were asking who it was. But then in Sheffield, the guy played three tracks from the album and it cleared the dance floor every time he played it, and so he's never going to play it again. So immediately you can see this report. Oh, okay, there's some people in Bournemouth who might be interested in seeing the band come down and actually do a gig. So inadvertently, you can actually start getting some data harvesting. You have to pay the club promotions people to actually do these mail-outs and then harvest the feedback. But I found it really useful, especially when you're working with bands which maybe don't have mainstream appeal. So you're not just shooting straight for the moon, that you're actually interested in building something that's longer lasting. That information coming back, there's immediate areas in the country where you could go tour, sell some t-shirts and make some friends. It's really useful.
Okay, can we just take a step back now and look at how you first introduce an act to the marketplace? John, I know you've had the experience of trying to do this a couple of times.
Yeah.
You know, how do you go about building an initial fan base? Because obviously a lot of the work is going to be live work, and trying to get an audience is going to be difficult.
Yeah, with Tina's situation, she when I first met her ten years ago, she made a conscious decision to want to have a career outside Denmark, and she made a decision to move to London, which was a very bold move, not knowing anybody over there, not even me at that point. So she made that decision, and once we established what she wanted to do, we introduced her to the right people over there that would be into what she was doing. Got her on 07's second record, and that gave her a lot of exposure, and got her a record deal with Sony in the UK, which turned into the In the Red Records, which then became very big over here. I would say her moving over there was instrumental in getting her started as much back here as it did trying to get some ripples going in the UK. The UK is always difficult. I mean, it's no matter how you dress it up, it's difficult. When she first came over, she paid Christian at the back there, probably helped to put her on at this place called the Cashmere Club, which is a singer-songwriter acoustic venue, 30 people in it, of which about 18 were A&R people. And they all thought she was great, but they all thought it was too early, she hadn't got any songs, and we didn't know what to do with her. So then you're going to go through the whole process of what do you do with an app like that? If they come over from Denmark for a weekend or for a week or something, they've got any money to stay. And if you're a band, you've got massive problems because you can't afford to live in London unless you've got a big record deal behind you. But being a solo artist, you could find a way forward to write their songs, to get the attention, and then that helped build a career back in over here. And with Hush, they actually signed to Universal in the UK directly in the end. And but again, it wasn't easy. You know, it's the cost issue of getting the band over to the UK, keeping them in the UK, keeping them on tour, playing with the right kind of bands that get them exposed in the media and the radio and things like that. But as we were just talking about the radio aspects of it there, I mean, it's almost a starting point. You've got to start somewhere with an act from this part of the world. You can't just say, right, I've got this amazing band, I'm going to move to London, because you're going to find £50,000 to put them up for, you know, 6 to 9 months to pay them a wage and to pay for their housing costs.
You don't necessarily know where that opportunity is going to come from either.
No, exactly.
Someone might show an interest and you kind of go explore
it. And the way I do my things at the acts, it's very organic, and it's very, we kind of ignore that the record labels are there, so we kind of pretend, what do we do if the record labels aren't there and we want to try and have a career in the UK? So probably the most direct and logical answer and the way of testing the market is by putting a record out and seeing if radio go for it. And then if you want to try and go down the traditional route of securing a record deal, if you get something on the radio, up to probably about a year ago, that might motivate the record company to want to come and see your band play and maybe give you a record deal. That seems to have changed now, and now you just might need one single, and they're ready for the third single to be a hit, and then they might be interested in coming to see your band play or sign you up. So it's the radio angle is definitely a direct route, but even for UK acts, it's just difficult. I mean, you can have an A-list record on Radio 2, which is the biggest radio station in the country, but you don't necessarily sell any records. You need band plays, you need some great TV exposure, you need some chat shows, press, all those kind of things. Then when you get those, then you start sending some records.
I was really lucky because Mew was spotted playing here by a Sony A&R man, and they'd already had a little bit of success here, and he decided that he was going to make it his mission to break them in the UK, and he found some really great support within the company. So by the time he'd completely messed up the record and messed up their career, and I got involved with Alan McGee, we managed to resurrect a record that had been wrecked and actually go back to the demos and find the good songs that they'd all missed and put together what we thought was a good record. But we had Sony Records behind us, and at the time we were very powerful because we had just sold Creation Records to Sony for a lot of money, so they would do whatever we asked them to do. So we spent £250,000 in 18 months on touring. We spent more on the artwork of the album than most people's albums cost to make. We absolutely raped and pillaged Sony for every penny we could get out of them. We insisted on touring America when we didn't have a release.
The good old days.
We insisted, we insisted on playing Japan when we had no presence there. We insisted on playing the Jakarta Jazz Festival when there was a riot going on in Indonesia. We were just absolutely brutal with Sony, but we were also determined that...
This is why Stephen walks around London in disguise these days.
That's why I don't have a deal with Sony, mostly. No, that's not true, but we did a job on them. We did a job for the band. We did their recognition in the UK did go up massively. They did start selling records, but I think even though we did all that, our biggest problem was the band suddenly had this huge expectation, and they thought that this would just carry on endlessly, and it wasn't. It was a one-off opportunity that we could go in and really get Sony to spend a lot of money and drive the marketing campaign, pay for touring, drive the records to radio, do video after video after video that was just like, you know, 100,000 each, you know, spend 30 grand on building a website when everybody else is 2 grand. You know, it was just completely ludicrous. And at the end of it, the MD said, "Should we do the next record?" We were laughing. We were going, "No, just give the band to us. You can't break this band. Just give them back to us because you're not going to break the band." And he said, "No, I'm committed." And we said, "Well, look how much we spent." And he said, "Yes, I'm committed." So we did it again. You know, we went back and we took them for the same money again. Unfortunately, we didn't have a very good record. And then I got fired because I was doing such a good job. No, then I got fired because I think the relationship between the band and during all that point, the band kept coming back to Denmark and built their career here, and they were doing really well here. And frankly, they could live off the money they were earning here, so their respect for their record company in the rest of the world went down and down because the label's inability really to break them on the level of their success here. So their earnings in Denmark were probably about the same as their earnings in the rest of the world.
You've got quite a good point there, because I think the benefit of having a go outside Denmark for Danish acts is that you feed that popularity and success, perceived success and notoriety back into the Danish market.
Well, they were signed to their own label here, so they got a huge amount of money.
Right here, and they signed a lot of records, but because of the attention she gets as being the tortured artist living overseas, that kind of thing, it's just fed back in here, and people like that.
Yeah, but I think that was helpful at first, but then it was counterproductive when they suddenly thought they can make more money doing next to nothing here than in the whole of the rest of the world, where, you know, it was always a problem. They had very complex production, they liked lots of visuals, it was a real big setup, and the costs of touring were phenomenal, and often, you know, to do international festivals, we had to have one production in one country and a complete set of production in another country. And those productions were like at least 50 grand each. You know, freighting bills were 5 grand a gig. These were like completely disproportionate to the 3 records we sold in Belgium that year.
Right, before we came, we're talking about some similarities between, you know, bands from Denmark going to try to break the UK, and the same sort of thing with UK bands going to try to break America.
Yeah.
And we were talking about time. Can I just get a sense from the three of you, the amount of time commitment you need to make to marketplace? Because I know that I lived and worked in America for a long time, and it was a real shock to me to find out, certainly in those days, that it took more than 3 weeks just to distribute the record, you know, just to get it out to all the record shops was a 3-week process. You know,
I think you have to set your targets. You know, you have to say to yourself, what level are you coming into the market? What's the relevance of success in Denmark? You know, can we translate that? Does that mean anything in South London? No, it doesn't really, unless you want to play to all the Danish expats in London. So it doesn't always translate. But in some ways, people at Radio 1 picked it up from a success in Denmark. People at MTV had seen videos that were made over here. So we had a couple of sort of tastemakers and a couple of journalists that were very useful to us because they thought, this is something unique, and how do we translate it? So I think we had to look at that and say, what is the timescale we need to break this act in the UK? And we thought we needed to concentrate on the UK, and we needed 9 months in the UK. If we got away with 9 months in the UK and we'd established a top 30 album, which I think we just did, without substantial radio play, then we needed to move to another territory. And that's when we persuaded Sony to make a release in America. What we didn't do is we didn't get the agreement of the band for them to go and live in America for a substantial period of time. And we were prepared to literally open ourselves an office in Los Angeles and take the band out there for 9 months, and literally with an agent who had committed to doing it, and with Sony giving us a sort of weekly amount of tour support, we were told to plan 6 months touring. But at that point, the band, for lots of different reasons, and some of which I did agree with and some of which I didn't, they wouldn't commit to that level of touring. They really felt that being out of the European market, being out of the Danish market for that long, not moving on to the next album would affect their career in their core country. And I don't think it would have, but I think actually that being in America for that long probably would have split them up.
So what do you think the time commitment is to the UK, John, for instance?
Well, Tina moved there for 7 years, yeah. So that's quite a
big time. But how long did it take her to break? Not so much.
Well, it didn't take her seven years to get to. I wouldn't say she's broken the UK at all. I think she's committed to the UK and America and now Germany as well. And she's never taken one penny into sport from anybody, which is obviously quite unusual in this day and age. But she largely tours solo or a duo or a trio overall to cut down the costs. And we just make sure that's an overhead we keep a big eye on. It's a bit of a different case because having to base herself over there, it's a different scenario. In America, though, she will, you know, she tours there twice a year and plays the same 8 cities pretty much on a rotational basis twice a year. So she probably spends a month a year in America doing that and doing the necessary promo, and she probably spends a month, 6 weeks in Germany every year as well now doing that. But it's relative to how many records she's selling and how much money she can make from touring.
The kind of artists as well. I mean, we're currently doing this at the moment with Kelemensch, we've taken them into the UK, and we have the brilliant sort of problems in that not only have we got an 8-piece band, which with crew goes up to 11 or 12 as a touring entity, so it's hugely expensive to transport them anywhere, but also they're in a specialist genre as well, so that we've got some really big problems sitting there. So when we're considering bringing them into the UK, we got some immediate great support from XFM and the BBC, and we actually took on a PR agent for the UK immediately before they even came to the UK. So that anything that they did, we would be trying to bring the alternative press to experience them live, because we knew we couldn't have a situation where they were going to play 150 shows in the UK to try and generate local interest just by doing, you know, the toilet tour, as we call it. It just wasn't going to be a financial possibility. So we took a PR guy on who took the album, which is fantastic anyway, and done pretty well in Denmark, but just took it to them completely cold and said, this band is playing next Tuesday, check the album out and come and see them play live. Fortunately, they listened to the album, loved the album, and they also came to the shows. So we immediately, off that first performance, started getting column inches, which then allowed us to consider what the next gig would be. They'd come into the UK and we'd do the same again and start building it in a very cynical and controlled way, really, because we needed to access the biggest audience possible. Radio was not really going to be helpful because we got a little bit of specialist support, but it wasn't going to be wide enough for us to start packing out venues. So we wanted to know if we could get all the magazines to support us properly, the readers of those magazines, if they saw 4, 5, 6 reviews, all saying 7, 8, 9 out of 10 for the performance, you know, the old marketing maxim is that you have to expose someone to an advert like 6 times before it even registers, and then it's probably going to be another 4 or 5 times until they might consider taking money out of their pocket. So with marketeers of toothpaste or whatever, they know they've got to batter the TV advertising before you'll even, you know, be conscious of a new product coming out. And we've decided to consider those things for our band. Let's hit people over the head with press, so they keep seeing this band in the press inches. And then let's really consider touring in the UK when we can get the album out, because we know we've got support from the labels. We'll make the album available in shops on iTunes. Then we're going to go and start really doing the touring and really starting getting people who have been hitting us now through MySpace and Facebook saying, when are you coming to the UK? When are you touring? We're generating that appeal without them actually having to be in the country where we're spending money. So most of the guys in Kennaminch right now are already still doing their part-time jobs, and they're not going to have to leave them for the rest of the year, because we're being controlled enough with the shows that they're doing in the UK that they'll come in for 4 or 5 days, do those shows. We'll have press at every single show that will keep generating the wheel of attention from other people, and we can then make decisions about how we want to invest. You know, are we going to invest a lot of money and keep them in the UK and do really comprehensive touring? And actually, similarly now, we're doing the same thing with Germany. And Germany is a few months behind the UK, but we're finding the same thing. The journalists are picking up on it immediately, and tastemakers in the industry are picking up on it immediately. So we're going to do a few select club dates where it doesn't really matter if the audience know who they are. The point is they're there, and there's going to be 5 journalists there, all with their arms folded. But I know I've got one of the most impressive live bands in the world, and so they will melt any ice cube going. But I think also the only reason really I wanted to take on the challenge is because they're brilliant. And I think, you know, it's a point that...
I love managers' commitment.
It's one of those things that I've heard other people say, that actually, you know, you can talk about artists and how good they are and how relevant they are and how they fit into a scene that's going on. But a lot of the time, if your artist is just amazing, you can sort of bypass a lot of those trend fashions and you can cut through to a few people. But it's actually going to actually turn into real commerce. Record sales or ticket sales is another thing. But we've taken that...
On what sort of level of financing are you doing all this?
Well, actually, we're having wonderful support from MXD and the people at Rosa, who are helping to fund the band's passage to the UK, which is incredibly helpful, and also having lots of introductions to people across Europe as well through those possibilities. And the rest of it is coming internally. The rest of it is, you know, a good thing about Kennaminch being an 8-piece band, it means 8 people are sharing the cost of doing something. So pro rata, it's actually quite possible for us to move them to small manoeuvres quite straightforwardly.
If any of you have tried to hitch, you know, a Danish act to a UK act in terms of touring, or, you know, something of a similar genre, and how did you go about that? I mean, in terms of, you know, getting exposure, because it can help.
I think with Mew, we did about 60 shows in the first 4.5 months, and every one of them was a support slot, and two of them were tours, and some we just picked off shows that we thought it was an appropriate band, it might introduce them, we needed to be in this town. And I think, you know, the biggest problem was getting bands to accept that we had more production than them, and we had more lights than them, and, you know, we should be headlining and they shouldn't be. And, you know, so it was that constant battle of technology that was the problem for us. But we did, probably on one of the tours, we collected huge numbers of website, of people's email address and people's phone numbers, and that started off the sort of huge hit rate that they got building up out of the first album. For their own website and developing a UK fan base. It definitely started it, but it was phenomenally expensive and really frustrating for the band dealing with the technological problems. It was really hard for them. But I think it's like the opposite, I suppose, would be Vic Runga, who's hugely successful in New Zealand, and we, you know, I think bigger than Madonna in New Zealand, 6 times platinum. and we brought her into the UK, and the only people that knew her were people from New Zealand, and so we said, look, you can go and play Brixton Academy and sell out to 5,000 New Zealand people, but they're not the people we want. We want these sort of people. And so we put her on a tour, just her and a guitar, and she played around the country, and that was instantly a lot more successful. It was instantly able to translate because we had no technology problems, we had no crew problems. It was just, life was so much easier and it cost effective.
As you, when you said put her on a tour,
yeah,
can you explain how that works? Because I think
bribery and corruption.
Yeah, I think here in Denmark people wouldn't necessarily get the subtlety of how you put an act on a tour in the UK.
Well, generally, I suppose the power of our company's repertoire, having so many earning bands, means that we can go to their agents and ask for a favour, and that was really effectively how we did it. We went to the agent, said, we've got this act coming in, you know, we think they're fantastic and we think we can break them in the UK. Sony are well committed, they've broken in Denmark, we really need them to tour, we have some issues with the production but we'll get around that, we'll try our hardest, can you find something relevant? And generally, although we swapped agents about three times on Mew, generally the agents were brilliant at finding something appropriate, and often it took us going to the other band's manager and say, not only do we want to do the show, but we'd be willing to contribute to the marketing costs and we'll flyer it.
That's what I mean here.
Okay.
Because normally there's a cost involved, isn't
there? The tour support, if you've got tour support coming out your ears, it's fantastic. And Kellerman should be offered some tour supports where the daily fee that they'll get for the support is £50 a day, which doesn't even put petrol in the van.
Yeah.
So when someone offers you a 2-week tour and you've got no tour support, I mean, you could seriously bankrupt the entire possibilities of an act by just trying it.
I tried to bankrupt.
But we don't have tour support,
yeah.
And it's just, it's kind of an impossibility. And also, the whole support act thing, it's kind of, there is a little bit of fool's gold there as well, in that people generally think, oh yeah, we're supporting Metallica, that means we're immediately playing to Metallica's whole audience, but also Metallica's audience don't give a damn who you are, and actually you're just the band they've got to get through to Metallica. So yes, you get to potentially farm your name out to a lot of people, but at the end of that tour, you know, actually what's tangible on paper about how you can turn it into business is really difficult, and without tour support,
I think some of what you say is right, but I think you have to be prepared to do the hard work, and that's the crucial thing. And if you're going to take a tour support, and then you have to be prepared to do it properly, and that means the band going out and selling their own t-shirts, the band actually going out and finding the fans, finding the people that next time when they come to that town, those people are going to help them sell more tickets. And it's really about that. If you take the money from the record company, you take the 50 quid from the gig, you go on when there's no one there, and you've got an attitude that you're huge in another territory, and you think it's disgusting that no one's seeing you, then you won't achieve anything. You have to go there with the attitude that you'll make the most of it. If there's three people in the audience, you'll go out and you'll try and make an effort, and I think that makes a huge difference. But occasionally you can take the wrong support slot. You can suddenly, you think, their audience and our audience have got, there's got to be an overlap somewhere, and it can go horribly wrong. And even when the agents and the record company were telling us this is really going to work, there were a couple of instances where it was really terrible, where we sort of said, we just really shouldn't do the next show, it's just really not working, no matter how much the band tried and changed their set even and went more acoustic and really like did everything they could, it didn't work.
I think what my point is, though, that sometimes a band that maybe don't have tour support will take that risk in the poker game and go, at the end of this tour, we're going to be on our toes and we're going to be running. And that is the most dangerous thing. You know, the management of a band has to be like the plate spinning cabaret act, where you've got to have all these other elements with the press, with radio potential, TV, radio, all these things in contention and rolling at the same time. Because if you put your cards down on that tour and that's all your budget gone and you're relying on running out the end of that into lots of business situations, the likelihood is you're just going to run off the end of the cliff and you're going to destroy everything.
I mean, it's not in terms of where we got to, it wasn't a great return on investment, but it was our only way to start, given that radio hadn't accepted us. We had a very lukewarm reception at prog rock in the UK, as Mew were seen. weren't considered very trendy by the NME when they were promoting the Libertines or, you know, similar things. So it was our only route in.
Let's ask John, because let's assume you've got the tour now, okay? And how do you use it? You know, how do you actually use it? Because
First of all, you don't manage bands.
Yeah.
It's just too costly and too time consuming. And again, going back to the people I work with, they can all play guitar on their own. And I've driven Tina around the country 3 times in my car. We just stay in the cheapest, when she started out, you just stay in the cheapest hotels. And, you know, it's as simple as that. You sell 30 CDs a night. You get your £100 fee for supporting somebody, or £300-400 fee for playing a small club show. And actually, at the end of the tour, if I pretend that I haven't done it for nothing, which I have done it for nothing, essentially, she's probably made, you know, but it's been going back several years, but, you know, she's made £2,000-3,000. So, I mean, that's the other end of the argument. In terms of what you do to gather names at shows or to get publicised yourself at the show, I've got another artist who's doing, she's opening for Martin Knopfler at Royal Albert Hall for 6 nights.
How did you get that to happen?
How did you get that happen? We got her people down to see her at Showcase last year in central London. It was somebody new that they were on the lookout for support, so we need somebody in the management company. They came down and saw her, which was great, and they offered 6 London shows. So that's 30,000 people she's going to play to in 6 nights. We thought about, so the obvious thing is you sell CDs at the shows, which the venue will then nicely take 25% for the privilege of selling your CD.
Just to interrupt. Notice that John said sell CDs at the shows, okay? Because there is a current trend to tell you have to give everything away, okay? And I'm very pleased to hear you say sell CDs at the shows, because it helps to cover your cost.
They cover your cost if you own the CD. If you have to buy them from the record label at, you know, at 90% of the retail price, then you don't buy CDs and you sell T-shirts instead. But you do that. You have your mailing list on the merch stands. All people I work with will run out as soon as they finish playing and go to those merch stands. We'll meet all the fans and talk to them and stuff like that. But one thing we did with Kate, as a case in point, we were thinking about handing out flyers around the Royal Albert Hall, which is obviously a very big venue in London. But the Royal Albert Hall would charge you a fee to do that, £500 a night, just for the privilege of flyering outside their venue, which is ridiculous. So what we're doing with Kate, she's just playing keyboard as a cello player, but we're hiring a big bass drum, and she's going to decorate the front of the bass drum with her name, with flowers on it, etc., etc. So on the front of the stage at the show, she'll be playing, and there's going to be this big bass drum, which is not going to get played, but everyone is going to know her name. And, you know, if they come in at any point during the half an hour that she's playing, not knowing who she is, and when you go to a concert and you see the support act, you never know who they are. Sometimes you don't care, but most of the time you probably don't care, but the kind of audience she appeals to is an older audience who don't go to that many shows, and they don't really want to know who she is, and don't dare to name. They go home, they get on the internet, they buy a CD, or they download a song. So that's how we do it.
I mean, the other thing we did several times is we did get access to the main band's website as well, and we did put up links between their website and our sites, and we did drive some traffic between the sites. And we also, for one of the bands, Mew, did a remix of one of their tracks. So we tried to do everything to encourage their fans to become our fans, and in a respectful way. We weren't trying to steal them all. So we tried to do that, and I think to a certain extent that worked.
Yeah. When it comes to touring in the UK, do you find that it's actually the point that you made, John, earlier on, and to some extent you made, Stephen, in the inverse way?
Yeah.
It's really important the band has actually a very small production.
Mm.
You know, because when you're looking for a support slot, often what the headline act want is an act that they can get on and get off as quickly as possible. They don't really care too much about what the music is. They know there has to be a support, and they want them to be as unobtrusive as possible. So it's something to bear in mind, I think.
Well, yeah. I think you eat into your own on-stage time.
Yeah.
You know, if the changeover between the bands takes so long, then you lose some of your set time. So
it is possible to condense stuff as well when you go out live, but only to a certain point. I was thinking, you know, people will say that you can go out and do an acoustic tour or whatever, and so long as that fits the kind of music that you play, then it's worth doing. I mean, I manage a band that, without all the acoustic instruments, like upright bass, and the gigantic distortion of the guitars, you just wouldn't get the effect that you need to get. So we have a minimum backline which goes everywhere with us, and no one's got gigantic amplifier stacks or whatever, but we need to push air, that's what we do. So it's not always possible for an artist to do it. And also, if it doesn't immediately fit, if people like you in your stripped down format, and then buy your album, and it's actually tons of electronica and guest rappers and everything, they're gonna go, well, this isn't that. Mm. And it's like a problem with remixing as well, where an indie band will get some techno remix done of their band, and people are like, oh, that's interesting, what's that? And then they'll go and actually hear the band with their floppy fringes and their guitars and go, well, why did you do that remix? It doesn't bear any reflection at all on how you normally sound. So I would say if you are going to pare down or even pare up what you're doing when you go on tour, make sure it sort of at least points towards what you usually sound like.
Okay, can we look ahead now and start talking about new media involvement? You know, how much time do you spend in terms of, you know, the kind of online marketing side? Obviously, it's not necessarily... It applies worldwide, but you have to focus it towards the UK. How do you go about that?
Luckily with Mew, they were great at building their own websites, making their own films, doing a lot of their own artwork. So we had a great starting point. And Sony weren't quite sure what to do with it, so we took control of some of the promotion budgets and directed it and did a lot of online work with basically students getting to student unions, getting into students and using links and sending unique material out that wasn't available on the Sony site or wasn't available via our site.
I think
so
you made a good point there, though,
about
who you're selling to. Because if the kind of music you make is bought by people over 35, actually making ringtones up or things like that isn't necessarily relevant to you. Whereas if you are in an 18-year-old electro-pop band or whatever, that could be super relevant to you, doing those sorts of things. So I think you've got to be aware of who you're selling your music to and how they're being exposed to music too, and be in that world as much as you can afford to do so. But if it's no point in just, you know, kind of clear-cutting all digital stuff, because there's so many doors to walk through, by the internet, by
I think viral marketing by its nature has to be targeted to its specific audience. So you know the route of your audience. You know, if you're a techno band, you go that route, and if you're progressive rock, for want of a better description, you have to go the route is where are the people with long hair, where do they live, you know, what sort of gigs do they go to.
In a way that's what I was aiming at, which is how do you tailor make your online presence so that you focus it on the UK. So you've got a band coming from Denmark.
I don't think you have to focus on the UK so much. I think a good artist now, when you go to their webpage or whatever, you can experience them with a 360-degree hemisphere around them. And you have to have that so you can walk into their world. You can see the imagery that is inspired by their music. You can see the videos which are inspired by their music. You can read blogs or create writing inspired by their music. You can see remixes or collaborations.
It's no good having all these wonderful things and no traffic. We have to drive the traffic.
But
if
you've got young people, they don't just want to go on and see what's essentially a corporate website saying, this is where we're touring.
Unless you do something to allow them to find it. And that's the bit
that's what I'm trying to say.
How do we get people to the site? How do we make the site more interactive? How do we get a Danish band to be more relevant in the UK market, which is what we're trying to do? I accept to a certain extent that once you develop a really good website, once you develop good marketing tools, they're applicable and useful worldwide, and audiences all around the world will pick them up. But, you know, we spent a lot of time and a lot of money saying that the band had already broken effectively in Denmark and to a certain extent in other places in Scandinavia, and we needed to make a huge move in the UK and then secondary in the US, third in Japan, so on. So we spent a lot of time working on viral campaigns, targeting other bands that we thought were linked in with them, targeting people that liked them and finding all the links between them and trying to drive all the traffic around by the use of
the social networking. I think people are getting smart to the fact though that bands now, they get in their MySpace profile and they hit people's site, and they don't just do a friend request, they send the message saying, hey, I see you like Nirvana, we're a bit like Nirvana too, please look at our website. And people are just deleting it because it's got...
But you have to be more subtle than that.
I think actually it's gone a little bit more traditional, in that there's so much noise out there right now.
Yeah.
That actually people are now returning to the traditional filters, like magazines or a blog site that they appreciate, and that they would rather hear about five good bands than 200 all in the same genre. It's too much noise. So you might be able to, you know, say if you've got a good website, which then gets seeded by someone on Drowned in Sound in the UK, or Play Louder, or Art Rocker, or something like that, and someone starts a great conversation, and they're a little tastemaker or early adopter.
You don't believe they're real, do you?
It doesn't matter whether they're real or not. If it makes
people
click
through.
But
that's how we did it.
Right.
You know, that's how we did it. We hired people that were clever enough to not go, you know, if you like Nirvana, you'll like Mew. We hired people to go, who do you know at this magazine? Who do you know at this magazine? How
those
can we get a remix to them? How
can you can
we
get your YouTube?
You
can get your video on YouTube in the top view videos in a couple of days, but it won't necessarily stay there.
It
won't
necessarily sell you any records.
Quite, but it's got to be. You've got to doing employing those marketing companies to seed stuff. They can get you driven up to the MySpace band of the day or whatever really quickly, but actually making it stick is where the person clicks through and goes, far out, there's so much here for me to digest. I need to actually spend time here. I'm going to come back later and I'm going to listen to all the songs, check stuff out, there's gigs going on, everything. So actually, when you see that link, that there's something there for people to go see.
But the crucial thing about it is, like, you know, we get to that stage and then we've got to drive it to sales, and it's like the consistency of the approach, the consistency of having the band in the UK market, the consistency of them not taking a year off between albums, you know, it's all those things that help to develop long-term careers. And that's really hard when you've got a band whose overhead, you know, in this particular market, for instance, it's really hard, even with the funding, it was really hard to hold that consistently together. And it's like we built up one album by every form of viral marketing and massive spend and ridiculous tour supports and everything we could. And then we had this big drop, and you know, the band took too long to make the next record, or you know, writing took a long time, and then production took a long time, and getting the producer took a long time. And by the time we got to the next stage, we were like starting again. Oh well, actually, we want to tour Denmark for 6 months.
John, have you found any particular areas in the blogosphere to be particularly useful in terms of, you know, just people starting to get a sense of what your band is all about? Let me ask you this question. Are there any bloggers out there that have an ear to the Danish market who are steering people?
To be honest, I don't really know. The whole blog thing, with the artists I've been working with, I think it's pretty more applicable to a brand new artist to begin with, because you need someone to start talking about a new act to their peers, and then this website in the UK called Hype Machine, and that really aggregates all the blogs that people were writing about an artist, and then you get the lazy A&R company. We look at Hype Machine and go, right, they're top of the Hype Machine this week, I must go and see them because everyone's talking about them. So it is useful for that side of things. But just going back to the point about the online side of things, again, I only know what I know about the people I work with. We have very neat, succinct websites and Facebook pages. MySpace page, I hardly ever look at anymore. I mean, all I do is put some, you know, the songs are on there, and some dates, and a contact. That's pretty much about it. I think it's become, from my perspective, it's become pretty redundant. I'd rather send people to a website from the Facebook page, or just allow people to interact as much as possible on the Facebook page. With Tina, we have a Danish page and an international page, so she can talk to the Danes in her own language, which I think is very respectful. I think the international side, then it's obviously different news for people who don't need to know what's going on in Denmark. I have to remind her to do both, but you know, she's generally very good at it. But
I think there's a real danger with a lot of the marketing that bands do through social networking, that there's no actual genuine reason for them to be doing it, in that they're trying to make people aware of who they are, and then once people are aware of who they are, they find out there's nothing going on with them. They haven't made a record, they're not touring. There's nothing going on. So you're in the sea of artists, you know, having a little bit of attention through a blog site at an early stage might put your head above the water. But it's going to take a big wave to actually wash you up on the beach to make it something real. And something we've done with Kelementry, we've actually taken all their music down from Spotify, so no one can listen to it. And we've taken it down from Last.fm as well, but I think it's gone back up there. And we're just going to starve everything there until we're ready to actually say, we're going to be in the UK, we're going to be on radio, we're going to do all these things. And so when people actually find the link, when people actually turn them onto it, they're going to go, oh, right, it's here, it's there. I can buy here, I can go see a gig here. And it all becomes available. And all these bands have these amazing tools like MySpace to make people aware of how little they've got going on. And it's just absolute noise, and I'm bored of it. I think a lot of people are bored.
But it's all about having a plot and a strategy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like you're absolutely right.
It's 12-month
like,
plan.
If the band always go on and they're blogging and they're sending emails out and like, how are you doing? It's like, it doesn't achieve anything. It's like, you've got to like sit down with every new act and work out how they fit in, what's appropriate for them, you know, what tools have they got, what are they unique at, you know, how can they help their career themselves, what can they do, as well as, you know, getting the money from the record company or getting the manager to put in the bits that they can't. It's got to be a long-term strategy. And frankly, you know, I've changed jobs and I run record companies now and I'm a digital distributor, but I still sign artists, you know, and I'm looking at signing someone and I'm going, okay, I am not going to make any money from you for the first 18 months of your career, so I want you, I'm going to commit to the first two albums, I'm going to commit to a marketing budget, I'm going to put a strategy together to break you in three different territories, and I'm going to spend this much money, and I don't care where I get to, but I am going to commit to this money and over this period of time, and I'm going to be consistent.
And there's that period as well where not only, you know, potential audience or record buyers, but also the industry too is bored of you by the time you get a record out. Because by the time you've generated enough interest to potentially get a record deal, it might take another 9 to 12 months for actually the whole machine to get your record made, and then they pitch the release date 5 months in advance or whatever. By the time your record comes out, all that buzz that you generated was just too early. And it just, you know, the sea goes back out again, and out you go with it.
One of the key things that I was going to point out, because I think John talked about it, in terms of the kind of background noise, one of my jobs, because I try to keep a few going, so when I get sacked, nobody notices, I can kind of move on to another one. One of the jobs that I do at the moment is I work at a collection society called PPL in London. And we register 13,500 new titles every week. So every week there are 13,500 recordings. So this isn't amateur stuff. These are people who have actually taken out a new ISRC code. So the competition is just so, so strong. Trying to actually rise above that and get some attention.
I think actually the game though is exactly the same. I mean, ever since Elvis came out, people have been trying to find those one-off unique opportunities to expose an artist to an audience who can then spend money. And whether it was appearing on the Ed Sullivan show or something like that, you know, there's now like countless doors where you can go through and be exposed to a tiny audience. And actually, you need to be smart about which ones are actually going to genuinely make a quantum shift in our business and actually propel us forward. And the likelihood of that happening through social networking is virtually zero. But getting one key TV performance or one key radio show and following it up with some support is going to make it far better for time spent than three members of the band hitting pretty girls who are 16 years old on MySpace and going, hey, how are you doing? I see you like Nirvana.
The last few minutes, I just want to see if there are any questions from the floor you'd like to put to the panelists.
I have one. Is it important to sort of brand a band with a nationality?
Somebody was saying that. No, that we can't find, there isn't a blog site for Danish bands, and it's absolutely true, there isn't.
But Scandinavian.com.
No, but one that's effective in promoting it, that's what we're looking for. And I think the whole thing is that we don't upplay where the band comes from,
no.
Particularly.
Right.
You know, we're very conscious that there aren't journalists who go out and say, I support all Danish bands. There are journalists who say, I like this type of music, or I like this band because their songs are like this. So very much we downplay it.
Yeah.
Until we need to get the Danish government to finance the touring.
But then you tell the Danish government that they shouldn't put DK after, mm-hmm. Right?
I think there's a difference between being honest.
I was just asking, because the Canadian government puts a lot of money into the Factor program.
Yeah.
They when I find some good artists and I finally find out that they are Canadian,
yeah. Yeah.
I haven't read about it anywhere. This is supported by the Canadian government or whatever.
If it's gonna be a positive to your audience, you tell them about it. If you think it's gonna be a negative, don't talk about it. If it's gonna be a negative,
don't play that. If they've got a problem, just don't play.
But I think there is that feeling, is it uncool to be Danish and going to the UK or America or something like that? If your band's good enough, I don't think people really give a damn. I think people are globalised enough now to go, if this is great and it's speaking to me and it's something that I understand, it's great. And it's a really good example of that, actually, with a band that's coming out of South Africa called The Antwoord, and they actually sing in Afrikaans and mix up English with Afrikaans slang. And they're just the most unbelievable visual prospect, as well as audio prospect as well. And it sort of destroys any of those boundaries of like, okay, South Africa, you know, how many South African artists can you mention that are in contemporary music? Virtually zero. But also their visual appeal as well, and it's somewhere between Eminem and the Gorillaz, but real people, you know, who are, you know, quite contorted and everything, and it's just the most compelling thing I've seen and heard for a long, long time. And it destroys all those things, but it's because they're brilliant. You know, if you are in an MOR rock band and it's got Danish, people might go, MOR rock, Danish, wow, this really isn't very sexy. But at that point, you're already losing. That's just putting another link in the chain that's keeping you in the sea. But if you're great, I don't think it matters where you come from.
You know what? I'll take issue with that a bit, in so much as in recent years, you know, a lot of the Danish producers and the Swedish producers, you know, are actually very, very fashionable and very popular, both in the UK and in the US.
That's slightly more industrial, though, than it is for consumers.
But the average consumer, they don't think in terms of industrial. They think in terms of, you know, where the pop music's come from, and they hear.
No, I think they don't even think about where it comes from. They don't know who the songwriters are or the producers. But they get a sense.
I mean, for instance, not a very good example, but sort of cartoons, people knew they were from Denmark. You know, Cardigans, all these, you know, the Scandinavian acts actually have made an impact, and it hasn't been a negative impact. And I know that now there is a kind of a cross Scandinavian body, which is actually including Iceland, you know, as an organisation in terms of actually promoting the music.
I think actually what you find is that industry may be negative. The consumers probably won't, but you might find someone in this. In fact, I've had someone that I approached about Kelemench, and who actually emailed me back and said, you mentioned Denmark and metal in the same phrase, and I wasn't very excited about hitting the link, but fortunately he did and liked it. But I thought, you prick, you fucking prick, you know, how dare you just sort of say that you read that and it meant you weren't going to be interested in it, you know. But it is that could be a reality, that an industrial person from the music industry might go, oh, I'm not being involved in Denmark, or whatever country it is, you know.
Has anybody else got a question from the audience before we wrap up?
Can I just say, I think even when you have to go to a venue, right, I think it's very important, when you're a Danish band, you don't have any fans just off the country, maybe you want to go and try the UK market. I think it's very important to be very good ground with the venues, so if you are able to get a lot of Danes down to start off, then it's a good ground to do it.
I think as a short-term measure, it's quite good, and I think absolutely a small venue in South London, if you can fill it on a Wednesday night when they normally get three people there, then you'll get a residency.
Yeah.
You know, so you can keep coming back, and that might be enough to keep you in London and support you and allow you to get to the next step. Absolutely.
That's a little thing about that.
The only problem with that is that we have bands in London who survive on that and they don't get out of it. Especially Australian bands in London.
Yeah,
they just all play to themselves, and it's almost like the people in the record industry, you know, what record industry, but people in the music industry suddenly sort of see it as a negative, and that wasn't why I was saying it.
It's not progressive.
Well, one thing I would say, because I actually saw, you know, at least one Danish band doing a showcase in London, and what happened was when it came clear to them that 80 or 90% of the audience were Danes, they actually spoke Danish for the whole gig. And that just guarantees that you're not going to break out that marketplace. So it's really important that even if you're using that to fill the room,
I think that's quite an old-fashioned approach. I think someone like Tina is now where she's at the stage where she's at over here and she's sort of fan base around the world, each city. And we're not trying to get a record deal, and we're not trying to impress. We're trying to make a living. Those sort of 5 years ago, it really worried me. She goes to a show in London, it's full of Danish people, and she accidentally steps into Danish and kind of go, oh my god, there's 3.5 years here, and they're not going to be impressed. That's such a minor part of it all now.
I suppose there's just different levels, aren't there?
Different levels, but I mean, it's fine, she can play down.
You can't pick your audience as well. You can't pick your audience. You never know where you're angling your music towards 21-year-olds and 51-year-olds like it. What are you going to do? Stop playing to those people. You know, there's plenty of artists that I'm working with at the moment who their initial approach to the market, their record labels are trying to take them to the contemporary radio stations, actually knowing though within two singles it's going to get catapulted over to sort of the Radio 2 market, over 30-year-olds, that kind of thing. But they're just going to try and wrestle on to, hold on to a little bit of the younger audience, so they might pick up some more branding tie-ups and that kind of thing, before it then moves audience. You just can't pick it, you can't tell people, you can't say we're not going to sell records to you, but we are going to sell records to you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we have to wrap it up now. I'm sure Tim, Stephen and John are going to be around for the next couple of days if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you.